listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Mixed signals coming out of Washington over a course to be followed in relations with Russia and China. We begin with this report from Jack Parrick of an announcement made by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who was attending a meeting of NATO foreign ministers in Brussels Tuesday, from China's global television network, CGTN.
The U.S. says it will no longer put up with Russian claims that Moscow hasn't developed a new intermediate-range missile system banned under the terms of a 1987 nuclear pact between the nations.
The United States today declares it has found Russia in material breach of the treaty, and will suspend our obligations as a remedy effective in 60 days unless Russia returns to full and verifiable compliance.
It's a move set to intensify tensions between Russia and the United States. NATO alliance members agree that Russia frequently violates the 30-year-old Cold War pact between Washington and Moscow to completely remove intermediate-range nuclear missiles from their arsenals. They say it's now down to Russia to save the deal by proving it's not in breach. NATO ministers also discussed the confrontations in the Azov Sea more than a week ago. Russia is still holding 24 Ukrainian soldiers captive after a military clash between navies. Ukrainian and Georgian ministers were welcomed to NATO HQ during this meeting as a show of support for the former Soviet states, a move which won't be appreciated in Moscow. NATO ships have spent 120 days patrolling the Black Sea this year, but Ukraine is asking for more, what it's calling a comprehensive answer to Russian aggression. And there are some here in Europe calling for action.
Either NATO or individual member states could give Ukraine more equipment to be able to defend itself. I mean, high-level equipment, for example, anti-ship missiles, could be put on the land. This would send a strong signal to the Russians.
Russia accuses Ukraine of provocation for the clashes in the Azov Sea, saying the shots it fired at Ukrainian ships were a retaliation. All eyes are now on Russia's reaction to the US threat to pull out of the INF treaty, which many fear could be the beginning of a global arms race. Jack Parrick, CGTN, Brussels.
That followed a tweet from President Trump on Monday, which said in part, quote, "I am certain that at some time in the future, President Xi and I, together with President Putin of Russia, will start talking about a meaningful halt to what has become a major and uncontrollable arms race." NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg gave a press conference at the beginning of a two-day session in Brussels on Tuesday, following a meeting with the former Soviet republics of Georgia and Ukraine. We bring you those remarks in their entirety.
Good afternoon. NATO foreign ministers have just met with the foreign ministers of Ukraine and Georgia. We addressed the security situation in the Black Sea region, including Russia's violations of Georgia's and Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Four years ago, Russia illegally annexed Crimea. Now Russia is attempting to use Crimea to expand its influence and control the Sea of Azov. Just a few days ago, we saw Russia use military force against Ukrainian ships and naval personnel. We call on Russia to immediately release the Ukrainian sailors and ships seized. Russia must allow freedom of navigation and allow unhindered access to Ukrainian to Ukrainian ports. Russia's pattern of disrespect for the borders of its neighbors includes military presence in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Russia must end its recognition of both regions and withdraw its forces from these regions of Georgia. In response to Russia's aggressive actions, NATO has substantially increased its presence in the Black Sea region over the past few years, at sea, in the air, and on ground. NATO ships routinely patrol and exercise in the Black Sea. This year, ships under NATO command have spent 120 days in the Black Sea, compared to 80 days the year before. Several allies conduct NATO air policing in the region. Allies also conduct regular reconnaissance flights, and we have set up a Romanian-led multinational brigade in Romania. Three NATO members, Bulgaria, Romania, and Turkey, are littoral states, so there is already a lot of NATO in the Black Sea. And we will continue to assess our presence in the region. At our meeting today, we agreed to continue working together to prepare Georgia for NATO membership. We recognize the significant progress Georgia has made with reforms, and we thanked Georgia for its major contributions to our mission in Afghanistan. We also restated NATO's solidarity with Ukraine. We recognize Ukraine's aspirations to join the alliance, and progress has already been made on reforms. But challenges remain, so we encourage Ukraine to continue on its path of reform. This is crucial for prosperity and peace in Ukraine. Allies greatly value our unique partnerships with Georgia and Ukraine. In different ways, each of them contributes to our shared security, and NATO remains committed to strengthening our ties with both countries. And with that, I'm ready to take your questions.
We'll go to the BBC over there.
Yes, thank you very much, Jonathan Marcus, Secretary General from the BBC. You've talked about NATO expanding its activities in the Black Sea region over the last few years, but clearly that has been insufficient to change Russia's behaviour in the light of the most recent events in the Sea of Azov. Have you tasked NATO military authorities to look at other steps to increase NATO military activity in the Black Sea, or are there other steps that individual NATO countries might take to provide greater assistance to Ukraine?
So NATO's presence in the Black Sea makes a difference, and we have significantly increased our presence there. And during the meeting today, allies clearly sent a message that they will continue to provide practical support to Ukraine, political support to Ukraine, but also continue to have a presence in the Black Sea region. Both within the NATO framework, but also some NATO allies have a presence bilaterally. We support the Ukrainian armed forces in different ways, with command and control, with cyber. Some allies also provide training in different areas. NATO helped them with to strengthen their naval capabilities. We helped them at the Naval Academy in Odessa. We also helped them to develop maritime capabilities, training exercises, and also port visits. And we will, of course, very closely monitor and watch the situation in the Black Sea region after the incidents we saw a few days ago. I think also we have to remember and understand that one of the reasons why NATO now is in the progress in the process of implementing the biggest reinforcement of collective defense since the end of the Cold War is actually Russia's aggression against Ukraine. We have battle groups in the eastern part of the alliance for the first time in our history. We have the Romanian-led multinational brigade in Romania. We have air policing in the Black Sea. And we have more naval presence. So all of this sends a very clear message from NATO and NATO allies to Russia.
We'll go to Ukrainian TV in first row.
Good evening. My name is Christina, TV Channel 5 Ukraine. So my question is, what will be the next steps of NATO in the case of further blockade of the Azov Sea by Russia, if it will continue, for example? Because as we all understand, it is quite dangerous. It is a threat not just for Ukraine, for Turkey, but for other European countries which suffer from this blockade and all the ships and vessels. Thank you.
So this meeting in itself was an important message, or sent an important message to Russia, because having all NATO allies, and some of them also have presence on the bilateral level in the Black Sea, and we have three littoral states, all NATO allies met with Ukraine and Georgia and sent a very clear message about our support. We are present in Georgia, we are present in Ukraine, and they committed to continue and to deepen the cooperation with both Georgia and Ukraine. We will, as I say, follow and monitor. We are following and monitoring closely the developments in the region, including, of course, in the Black Sea. And then we will, based on our assessments, continue to assess our presence in the region.
Itartas, second row, center.
Thank you very much, Denis Dubrovin, TASS News Agency. Mr. Secretary General, 4 years ago, your predecessor, Mr. Anders Fogh Rasmussen, has called for restraint in suppressing the Maidan protesters in Kyiv. Would you call now for restraint for the French forces of police forces to when they're suppressing the riots of Gilets Jaunes? Merci.
I first of all, I think that's no meaning in comparing those two situations. And I also think that to try in any way to compare that is totally wrong. Then the important thing for NATO is that we support the territorial integrity of Ukraine. And we will never accept and recognize the illegal annexation of Crimea and that Russia continues to destabilize eastern Ukraine. And we have to understand what happened near the Sea of Azov in this context. Because first Russia annexed Crimea, then they built a bridge, and then they used the annexation of Crimea and the illegally built bridge to try to take control over the Sea of Azov. So therefore, we continue to call on Russia to release the ships, release the naval personnel, but also allow Ukraine access to the Sea of Azov with both commercial ships and military ships. Because that's actually an agreement between Russia and Ukraine, and Russia has to honor that agreement. To impede access for Ukrainian ships into the Sea of Azov will be something which is absolutely in violation of the agreement between the two countries, and it's a new example of how Russia is not respecting the territorial integrity of its neighbors. So this is what this case is about.
Very last question, Rustavi 2, lady in second row.
Georgian TV company, Rustavi 2. Secretary General, does the Ukrainian side raise some new initiations about this situation? And second, Hungarian Foreign Affairs Minister, he made a statement that he will raise issue about the membership action plan to Georgia. Do you discuss on this meeting this issue and which kind of position has other allies? Thank you.
So this was one of the topics we addressed in the meeting. I think I will leave it to each individual ally to refer what they actually said in the specific meeting. But in general, I can say that we strongly support Georgia on its path towards NATO membership. And NATO's heads of state and government, they stated as late as in July that Georgia will become a member of the alliance. We continue to provide support to Georgia to implement the necessary reforms. We commend the progress Georgia has made, and we continue to work with Georgia in modernizing their armed forces, building strong institutions, and we have the Training and Evaluation Center in Georgia, which we use to work with Georgia. That is important for Georgia, but it's also important for NATO, because it strengthens the interoperability of our forces. And many allies expressed in the meeting today that they are extremely grateful for the strong contribution of Georgia to different NATO missions and operations. So I think this meeting was a strong message of solidarity between NATO and Georgia and NATO and Ukraine, and that we stand together.
Thank you very much. This concludes this press point. Thank you.
Thank you.
Following that press conference, Stoltenberg joined the foreign ministers of NATO members to discuss a lengthy agenda of issues. When they emerged late Tuesday, he made this announcement.
All allies have concluded that Russia has developed and fielded a new ground-launched cruise missile system, the SSC-8, also known as the 9M729. Allies agree that this missile system violates the INF Treaty and poses significant risks to Euro-Atlantic security. And they agree that Russia is therefore in material breach of its obligations under the INF Treaty. The treaty has been a pillar of Euro-Atlantic security for more than 30 years. It eliminated an entire category of weapons and made us all safer. For over 5 years, the United States has made every effort to engage with Russia and to seek answers about the new missile. The US has raised the matter formally with Russia at senior levels more than 30 times. Other allies have raised it with Russia too. We did so a few weeks ago in the NATO-Russia Council here in Brussels. But Russia has continued to produce and deploy the new missile. Russia's violation of the INF Treaty erodes the foundations of effective arms control and undermines Allied security. This is part of Russia's broader pattern of behavior, intended to weaken the overall Euro-Atlantic security architecture. There is no question that the United States fully comply with the treaty. There are no new US missiles in Europe, but there are new Russian missiles in Europe. Arms control agreements are only effective if they are respected by all sides. A situation where the US abides by the treaty and Russia does not is simply not sustainable. We call on Russia to return urgently to full and verifiable compliance with the INF Treaty. It is now up to Russia to preserve the INF Treaty. NATO allies remain firmly committed to preserving strategic stability and Euro-Atlantic unity. NATO will continue to ensure the credibility and the effectiveness of the alliance's overall deterrence and defense posture. We will continue to consult regularly, and we will continue to keep Russia's military posture and deployments under close review. At the same time, all allies are firmly committed to supporting and strengthening real and verifiable arms control. NATO exists to prevent conflict and preserve peace. And we seek dialogue, not confrontation, with Russia. We don't want a new arms race. We don't want a new Cold War. So allies will continue to work for a better relationship with Russia. We will continue to engage, including through the meetings of the NATO-Russia Council. So Russia now has a last chance to come back into compliance with the INF Treaty, but we must also start to prepare for a world without the treaty. And then I'm ready to take your questions.
Okay, Wall Street Journal.
Dan Michaels, Wall Street Journal. In the discussions today, was there any dissent? Was there anyone saying that the U.S. was moving too quickly to announce it was leaving officially the INF? Thank you.
All allies agreed, and we have reflected that agreement in the statement. And the statement is very clear, very strong, and it states clearly that Russia is in violation and Russia is in material breach of its obligations under the INF Treaty. We also say that Russia, it's up to Russia now to preserve the INF Treaty. They have a last chance to show and demonstrate in a verifiable way that they comply with the treaty, but we also have to prepare for a world without the treaty. And that's exactly what we now do. We state that Russia is violating the treaty. We call on them to come back into full compliance with the treaty, but we also start to prepare for the fact that this treaty may break down because Russia, after years of engagement from our side with them, they still don't provide any credible answers to all our questions.
Okay, NPR.
Hi, Terry Schultz with NPR and Deutsche Welle. NATO has known for quite a while that this was the U.S. intention. So when you say now that you will start to prepare for a world without this arms control treaty, what does that mean? What are some of the ideas that you're looking at? And also, when you were asked about dissent, we know that not all countries would choose this as the step for the U.S. to take today. So, I mean, simply repeating that they all agreed on this statement doesn't mean that there aren't allies who believe differently.
I think the way we have handled this issue demonstrates the strength of NATO. We are 29 allies. There are sometimes discussions. There are sometimes need for to sit down and meet and discuss. But at the end, we're able to agree. And this statement is a strong demonstration of the unity and the strength of the alliance, because it sends a very clear message about who is responsible for the violations and the fact that the INF Treaty is now really in jeopardy, and it also sends a message to Russia about that they have a last chance to come back into compliance. So I really believe that this shows how important it is that we have done exactly what we have done, that we have consulted, that there has been briefings, that we have shared intelligence, and then that we have been able to agree on a common position on the way forward. And this is very important, and this is really serious, because, of course, all missiles are dangerous. But these missiles are in particular dangerous because they are hard to detect, they are mobile, they are nuclear capable, they will reduce the warning time, they can reach European cities, and therefore they also reduce the threshold for a potential use of nuclear weapons in the conflict. That's the reason why the INF Treaty has been so important, and that's the reason why it is so serious that this treaty now risks breaking totally down because of the Russian violations. The last thing I would say is that we are constantly assessing the military posture of Russia. We have strengthened our collective defense, and we will then, of course, also assess the consequences of the deployment of the new Russian missiles.
Okay, Financial Times over there.
Thank you. Michael Peel, Financial Times. Was there much discussion of potential next steps if Russia doesn't come into compliance, and are there concerns, particularly among European allies, of the prospect now of fresh US missile deployments in Europe, possibly contributing to exactly the kind of arms race you want to avoid?
The important message from this meeting is that we will continue to discuss and address this issue within the NATO framework. We will collectively develop a set of responses. We will do that in a measured, considered way because this is very serious, and we need to analyze the consequences of each and every step. That's exactly why we need to do this as an alliance, all 29 allies together. The INF Treaty, the US is part of party to the INF Treaty, all the NATO allies are not. But of course, the consequences of a breakdown of the INF Treaty will be there for all allies. This affects the security of all allies. And therefore, I welcome the fact that the United States has consulted over months and long time with NATO allies. This was an important issue at the previous defense ministerial meeting in October. It was an issue addressed at the summit in July, and it has been an issue which has been discussed within NATO for some time. So it's too early to conclude now, but the important message is that we will do this as an alliance. We will have a collectively developed response.
Washington Post, up there.
Thank you. Michael Birnbaum from the Washington Post. Mr. Secretary General, you've spoken repeatedly over the years about how the missile deployments of the 1970s and 1980s shaped your perspective as a person and as a politician. I wanted to ask what you feel it means for your legacy as a NATO Secretary General to preside over an era that likely does see the end of the INF Treaty. Thank you.
I regret that we now most likely will see the end of the INF Treaty. But at the same time, we don't have any other alternative than to react in the way we do. Because we have to remember that the no arms control agreement will work if it's only respected by one party. And the problem with the INF Treaty is that the United States is in compliance while Russia is violating the treaty. And that's not only a problem for the INF Treaty, but that's a problem for all other arms control treaties. Because if we accept violation of one treaty, then we also undermine the credibility of all the other arms control treaties. So this is part about trying to defend the INF Treaty, but also about trying to defend the whole idea of verifiable arms control. You are right. For me, the issue of intermediate range nuclear weapons shaped my understanding back in the 70s and the 80s about security and defense issues. I think it shaped a whole generation of young politicians, especially in Europe. We were very concerned about the deployment of SS-20s, intermediate-range Soviet Union missiles, but also concerned about the NATO response, the Pershing and cruise missiles. Therefore, we all really welcomed, and we really felt that the world was moving forward when the Soviet Union and the United States in 1987 agreed on the INF Treaty. And this was the first treaty that didn't only put a ceiling on the number of weapons or reduce the number of weapons, but actually banned all weapons, abolished the whole category of weapons. So therefore, this was really arms control at its best. And therefore, it is a really a big setback if this treaty now breaks totally down. So we will reach out to Russia in many different ways. Just the fact that we now have this united NATO position sends a clear message to Russia. Second, NATO allies meet with Russia bilaterally in different formats with the heads of state, government, foreign ministers, and so on. And they raise this issue with their Russian counterparts. And they will also do so in the following days and weeks. And we are also ready to raise this issue again in the NATO-Russia Council. We did so just a few weeks ago. So Russia know our position. They know our concern. In the beginning, they denied the existence of this system. Then actually, they were not able to deny the existence of the system, but then suddenly they changed their explanation and said, yes, the system exists, but it doesn't violate the INF treaty. But we are ready, of course, and to talk to Russia. We did that in the NATO-Russia Council. We are ready to do it again. But I think this is actually not so much a question of how many meetings we will have with Russia, because they very well know our position. This is about whether Russia wants to preserve the INF Treaty. If they so want, they can comply with the treaty. If not, then this treaty will not survive.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Yemen and the politics of denial and deceit. The Trump administration's continued support of the Saudi-led war is morally indefensible and strategically counterproductive. Blaming Iran for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen only ensures more suffering. It is time to end this senseless conflict. Crosstalking Yemen, I'm joined by my guest, Giorgio Caffiaro. He is the CEO of Gulf State Analytics, a Washington, D.C.-based geopolitical risk consultancy. And in Norman, we cross to Joshua Landis. He is the director of the Center of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Joshua, let me go to you first in Norman. Can you explain something to me? This is something the President of the United States, Donald Trump, said on November 20th of this year. Quote, the country of Iran, as an example, is responsible for a bloody proxy war against Saudi Arabia in Yemen. Then he further says, on the other hand, Saudi Arabia would gladly withdraw from Yemen if the Iranians would agree to leave. This would immediately provide desperately needed humanitarian assistance. Additionally, Saudi Arabia has agreed to spend billions of dollars in leading the fight against radical Islamic terrorism. Now, we could spend hours dissecting those few sentences here. It seems to me that the reality is completely opposite of how President Trump and Mike Pompeo and John Bolton are characterizing what's going on in Yemen right now. Your reaction, Joshua.
Well, it is. And the UN resolution that they passed on Yemen is really requires the Houthis in the north to completely surrender. And it's quite clear they're not going to do it. And any effort to force them to surrender is going to require taking Hodeida, the port, in from which all of the grain goes in, and humanitarian assistance. It would cause widespread famine from one end of Yemen to the other. Right now, the peace talks are going on to try to get some kind of agreement, but that would mean Saudi Arabia really stepping back from its maximalist goals. And that's going to be hard to do because, as we've seen, MBS is not a compromiser.
Yeah,
he has rashly pushing his favor, and he's really broken in many ways the Gulf alliances. And we see that with Qatar totally alienated, with Yemen in shambles. And now the North, with Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, increasingly coming under the sponsorship or forming an alliance with Iran. So Saudi Arabia feels surrounded, but isn't that of its own doing?
Feeling surrounded. I mean, it's its policies that have backfired against it. I mean, as you're saying, it's breaking down all the alliances. Let me go to Giorgio in Washington. It seems to me that the more the Trump administration backs this maximalist policy that Saudi Arabia is pursuing, the less likely there can be a peaceful resolution of this conflict that could be easily resolved if there was the political will in Riyadh and if there was some prodding from Washington. Go ahead, Giorgio.
Well, what we see from this administration is one that fully endorses the Saudi government's narrative about the crisis in Yemen. From the perspective of the regime in Riyadh, the prospects of the Houthis establishing a de facto state or a proto-state in northern Yemen would amount to more or less the same idea as Lebanese Hezbollah establishing a foothold on Saudi Arabia's border. Now, I think this narrative has many flaws, but it's clear that the Trump administration buys into it completely. You know, when we read Mike Pompeo's recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, you know, to be fair, this read more like something that a Saudi lobbyist would write rather than an American Secretary of State. So while I think there's total reason for everyone to conclude that a military solution is not in the cards in Yemen and only a diplomatic resolution can bring stability and peace to the country, I think the administration still believes that the Saudis and the Emiratis and others in this coalition can achieve objectives on the ground through continued fighting. And unfortunately, the people of Yemen are going to be paying the biggest price for a continuation of this thinking on the part of the administration here in Washington.
You know, Joshua, Mike Pompeo at the recent G20, for me, it was almost surreal. He acknowledged, yes, there is a massive humanitarian crisis being played out in Yemen, but he won't really do anything about it. And I think that's what I think. And even the mainstream media found it, I think, shocking. He understands what's happening there, but he won't lift a finger to reverse what's going on there. So explain to me, Joshua, why this alliance, the American-Saudi alliance, is worth the genocide of an entire nation. Go ahead, Norman.
Well, you know, Saudi Arabia has been the linchpin of U.S. policy in the Middle East, that in Israel, for ever since the Iranian Revolution in 79, when the United States really was pushed out of the entire Gulf region because Saddam Hussein was in Iraq, and doubled down on Saudi Arabia, built 9 nuclear-hardened bases around Saudi Arabia that the Saudis paid for it all. But the pertinence is the military complex in Saudi Arabia is better than anything in NATO. And the United States can project power from that region and keep its control over the Persian Gulf. And that means it has its hand firmly on the oil tap. And if the United States learned one thing in World War II, it was that oil makes the world go round. And in many ways, the Allies defeated Hitler.
Yes.
Because of the control of oil. And the Russians know this better than anybody because they fought Stalingrad, which was about Hitler getting to Russian oil. and by the Caspian Sea. They stopped Hitler. They won the war. And today, the United States is geared up for World War III, or is prepared for it. And that means controlling oil. And if the U.S. were to allow the alliance with Saudi Arabia to deteriorate, in many ways, it would be giving up its throne as the great superpower. And Americans like to be a superpower. Every 4 years, we go through elections,
yeah,
and every single candidate has to go out and campaign about how America is the greatest nation in the world, indispensable.
Okay, but Joshua, let me stay with you here. But is Saudi Arabia a good alliance partner for the United States?
That's what we've seen with Khashoggi, with the rise of Salafi jihadism, with militias in Syria and Iraq being funded by Saudis. And this has turned into a real Frankenstein in a sense. You know, the Saudis of the 70s and so forth was a fairly benign power, and political power within the kingdom was distributed amongst the brothers, and there was a collegial, fairly benign rule. Today, MBS has gathered that power into his hands. He's alienated his brothers. He's using increasing amount of force to intimidate them, to shake them down. And we're seeing a Saudi Arabia that we don't really recognize. It's becoming more and more fragile. The world is condemning it. After Khashoggi, we saw this really nasty face come out. And it is, you know, Turkey has been playing on this, and Turkey, in a sense, is torturing America and Saudi Arabia by saying, don't put all your eggs in the Saudi basket. We are here. Look to Turkey. And it's saying, you know, we can help bring down Saudi Arabia, and you'll be naked in the Middle East. You have to diversify. And that's what America will not do. And what you asked me is, you know, in a sense, by alienating Iran completely, by undermining its relationship with Turkey over the last, you know, 5-6 years, the United States has left itself really with only one tent peg in the Middle East, maybe two with Israel, but one in the Arab Middle East.
Okay, well, let me go to Giorgio. I mean, is that a very wise move? I mean, considering what Saudi foreign policy has been over the years, the invasion of Bahrain, funding jihadist rebels in Syria, alienating Qatar, heightening tensions with Iran. I mean, they've really, everything they do seems to be counterproductive to projecting security for the kingdom. I mean, I'm at a complete loss, and maybe that's why the CIA is pushing a different narrative about the Khashoggi affair, because, well, maybe Senator Lindsey Graham and others are looking for one of the brothers to take his place. Again, a meddling in foreign politics. Maybe in this case, it wouldn't be a bad idea. I don't know. Go ahead in Washington.
Well, I think you're absolutely right to point out that some of the biggest foreign policy decisions that MBS has made, from the war in Yemen, the blockade in Qatar, and so on, there has been blowback that Riyadh has had to deal with, many unintended consequences, some of them very destabilizing for the region. When we're talking about the U.S.-Saudi alliance from Trump's perspective, let's keep in mind that his administration has really three key goals in the Middle East. Number one is to confront Iran and to counter Iranian ascendancy in the region.
Mm-hmm.
Second, to secure lucrative contracts for American entities, public and private sector. And third, to protect the state of Israel as much as possible. Trump sees Saudi Arabia playing an incredibly important role in terms of all three of these objectives. From this White House's perspective, it is the conduct of Iran that poses the biggest threat to U.S. interests and the interests of U.S. allies in the region. And I think the administration believes that it's not realistic to envision Washington successfully countering Iran without unifying Sunni Arab states together. And clearly they see Saudi Arabia as being so central to this agenda.
Well, it's interesting, because then it looks like the United States is the junior partner in this alliance, because it doesn't have enough leverage to be able to convince its ally that is so dependent on the United States for so many things to change its behavior. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Yemen. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Norman. Joshua, we heard from Giorgio before we went to the break the importance that Saudi Arabia plays in confronting Iran. But if we can go back to 2003 with the illegal invasion of Iraq, all the way to the present, it seems to me that U.S. policy and the pillars that were just mentioned, at every step of the way, they have degraded their own position in the Middle East, one catastrophic mission after another. Actually, right now, there's a mission being played out in Syria. What that mission is not particularly clear. Through time, it will come into focus here. It might be a part of the obsession, the absolute obsession with Iran. Is this why the U.S. will not confront Saudi Arabia? Because of the interests of Israel and, of course, the way the Saudis see their position vis-a-vis the Iranians? But like I said in the first part of the program, everything that Saudi Arabia does, at least recently, is actually damaging to its security interests and projecting its foreign policy. So maybe doing nothing might be better than doing something. At least logic would dictate after, 15 years of just catastrophe. Go ahead, Joshua.
Well, you're right to point to the catastrophe. A lot of this damage has been self-inflicted, and that really starts with the this conception, a false conception, that the United States could reshape the Middle East,
exactly.
Staying in Afghanistan after the initial invasion and then invading Iraq, thinking that we could get rid of oppressive autocrats and build democracy in the Middle East. And now, of course, there were lots of good arguments for why we could do that, because Eastern Europe had just turned to democracy in the 90s, and in Latin America, and the whole idea of the fourth wave in the Middle East was ripe for this. But that ripeness turned out to be completely false. It was not low-hanging fruit. And in Iraq, didn't work. And America got sucked in, spending trillions of dollars, and of course, hurting our economy badly, and turning Iraq into a friendly place for Iran, which, of course, completely alienated, frightened the Saudis and have turned this situation. Now, this president administration thinks it can turn that around and pin back the years of Iran, push them out of the Middle East, out of Syria, out of Yemen, and move them back out of Iraq. And that is not going to happen. There is a new security architecture in the Middle East, and Russia is very much at the forefront of it and has helped Iran and has linked up with Iran. And America created this alliance in a way, because Iran had always been neither east nor west. But by sticking it to Iran over and over again and their economy, Iran has had to reach out to Russia. And the two of them have really found the weaknesses in American foreign policy, saying you can't change the Syrian regime. You're going to create tons of militias that are extremist and that are going to hurt us. And this is been the foundation for the Iranian-Russian alliance. And of course, they were correct in their analysis, because that's what happened in the Syrian arena. It didn't turn into democracy. It turned into radical militias. And so the United States backed away from Syria. It's got spooked by its own allies in Syria. And this opened the door to Russia. And Russia has been consolidating, and so has Iran in the north. And the United States isn't going to push them out, unfortunately, for the United States. It's only going to weaken itself, and it's going to weaken its allies, it's going to weaken its allies, both Saudi Arabia and Israel, in the process by trying to gear up for this Mission Impossible.
You know, Georgia, it's very interesting is that, the ascendancy of Iran. Well, let's say that is true. OK, but why is it ascendant? Because of the Iraq war, okay? That's their influence spread, okay? Then in Syria, when this international proxy war heated up there, the legitimate government of Syria invited the assistance in many different forms of Iran. So Iran moves a little bit more further west, okay? That's all a reaction to Western policies of destabilization in the region. That's why I said my original question to Joshua is that maybe it's better to do almost nothing, because the more they seem to push their policies, the more it backfires against them. Go ahead, Giorgio.
Yeah, and to bring this back to the country of Yemen, I think your point is very valid. You know, the Houthis began their uprising back in 2004. At that point, the Houthis had virtually no links with the Islamic Republic of Iran.
True.
But as the situation has remained very dark in Yemen, there's been a lot of suffering. And Iran, I think, today certainly does have a hand in Yemen. I think many people exaggerate the Iranian role in Yemen, but I don't want to be dismissive of the fact that Iran does have a hand in this civil war.
How would Georgia, let me ask you. I mean, if it is a blockaded country right now. So what kind of material support could Iran, when the country is blockaded, its ports are closed, the country is contained. So, I mean, even if Iran wanted to materially support the Houthis, which I don't see much evidence of, no one's presented it, how could they do it with a country being blockaded?
Well, the blockade might not necessarily be airtight. And of course, there are different sources that claim different facts. But my understanding is that Iran has put weapons into the hands of the Houthis since the civil war began, even though I think it's important to state that many analysts do exaggerate the extent to which Iran is involved in the country. But nonetheless, even from a political or ideological perspective, I think Iran can gain even more influence in Yemen if the suffering continues.
Sure.
This is going to breed more anti-Americanism in Iran. Has been very skillful since 1979 of exploiting anti-Americanism, whether we've seen that in Turkey, in Gaza, even in parts of Africa and elsewhere throughout the greater Islamic world. I think it would definitely be in the longer term interests of Saudi Arabia and the UAE to try to reach a deal with the Houthis, establish peace in Yemen, as difficult as that is to imagine. I think that obviously has to be the goal. And through some reconstruction efforts in Yemen, I think the goal should also be for Saudi Arabia and the UAE to try to bring the Houthis back to the Arabian fold. I think this continued aggression against the Houthis is only going to offer Iran more opportunities to assert influence in the Arabian Peninsula.
Okay, Joshua, before all this started, particularly over the last few years, the Iranian influence was minimal at best. Maybe it's increased. But if it's your enemy's enemy, so I can understand that. Plus, there is a slight religious connection. How stable is the House of Saud right now? Because you read all of this paid for propaganda up until this Khashoggi affair. I mean, with MBS taking power, grabbing power, is it a more stable place or destabilized place? Go ahead.
Well, I think your question is very important about stability. And the Saudi Arabia today is going through a tremendous transition from the generation of the children of Abdulaziz ibn Saud, the founder of the kingdom. And his children have ruled ever since he died. And now they're passing it to the next generation. So that means all those brothers and those other families are getting cut out. And in a sense, Saudi Arabia was created on the battlefield, conquering other tribes. But it was also created on the marriage bed. And Abdulaziz ibn Saud made love as well as war. And he built the nation by taking a wife of every major tribe that he conquered. And those children from that, you know, in a sense, he built a super tribe out of Arabia that had been a bunch of tribes fighting each other and chaotic. And he built a super tribe that is the Saudi nation, soi-disant. And today, that national integrity, that super tribe, is shuddering with all kinds of the centrifugal forces are potentially going to break Saudi Arabia apart if this transition to the next generation doesn't go smoothly. And that problem of internal insecurity has plagued every regime in the Middle East. And it's really the problem with the Middle East today, because it's causing the sectarian religious fanaticism, if you will, because all of these weakened players internally are using religion to rally people to themselves. And we've seen this since the Iranian Revolution in 79. the order, which was based on secular nationalism after the First World War, and you had Saddam Hussein and Assad and, you know,
Gaddafi,
and Nasser, all of the Arab nationalists have collapsed. And today they're being replaced with religious nationalists. And this is tearing apart countries from one end of the Middle East to the next because they don't know how to live together. And Saudi Arabia, unfortunately, has been defined by its Wahhabi
ideology. Exactly what I wanted, where I wanted to go here. Let me go to Giorgio in Washington. Is Wahhabism reformable in the way that MBS is trying to sell it to the West through paid for propaganda? Is Wahhabism reformable?
Short answer, yes. I do believe that Wahhabism
I wish we had more. I wish we had more than a minute, because I would really like a long discussion on that. You can finish up the program. Go ahead.
I think MBS has received a lot of condemnation, a lot of criticism for many reasons. I think a lot of that is very legitimate. I do think there are some areas, though, where he does deserve credit, such as women driving, permitting cinemas to reopen after they were banned for several decades, allowing an entertainment sector to start up. I think this is important for the diversification of Saudi Arabia's economy, which is in the
also
interest
of
the whole
world.
We
probably should mention, we should also probably mention the illegal detention and kidnapping of his own family members and extortion and torture. Is that reform? 10 seconds. Go ahead.
MBS is not making political reforms in Saudi Arabia. There was never any talk about the kingdom democratizing under MBS, but there are some social reforms taking place which are important, and I would definitely not dismiss them.
Okay, that's a fair answer. Okay, that's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in Norman. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.